Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And now we have a good friend from Spain, Pepe Reventos, more formally, I guess, Josep Reventos, yes?
Yeah, Pepe is perfect, Tony.
And so Pepe is a friend we met through the wine business and traveling in Spain. And you have a pretty unique family history in sparkling wine in Catalonia, no?
We have a pretty unique history. What I like to say is that my family is one of the most boring families in the world because we have been doing the same thing for over 500 years.
It's amazing. The first documents
we have are from 1497. And since then, we've been producing grapes in Penedès near Barcelona, in the same property. Yes.
And so, what do you make? What does the family make now, and what did it make historically? When, because people producing grapes, producing wine, and actually bottling your own wine and labeling your own wine under your own name, those are all different steps along the path. No.
That's exactly correct. In the early stages, in the 1400s, it was a traditional Mediterranean farm with animals and different indigenous plants like olives and like almonds and obviously the vineyard. And from there, we started to develop a more commercial vinification in the 1700s. And then the first sparkling wine in Spain was produced by the grandfather of my great-grandfather in 1872, Josep Reventos Fatjó, in the same farm and with indigenous grapes. That was the miracle, no? To use Xarello indigenous grapes and produce the first sparkling wine. And since the 1872, we've been focused in producing sparkling wines.
And so the basic difference, and that wine in Spain is called Cava, yes?
Correct. That's when in the early stages we would call it Spanish Champagne, but then France protected the name, which is totally smart and understandable. So we had to create our own name. And my grandfather actually in the mid 90s created the name Cava, and he became the first president of the AOC, the Consejo Regulador del Cava. And focused in exactly the same method as Champagne, but in a totally different climate and indigenous grapes.
And so the Champagne grapes everyone seems to know these days, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier, Cava made from indigenous grapes in San Sadorni, or from what grapes?
In the case of Cava, the grapes are Xarello, Parellada, and Macabeu, mainly. But to be honest, Cava lately has become a little messy and mass produced because it's been open to produce all over the country, and also all the foreign grapes are accepted. So with my father last year, we decided to remove from Cava, and I know it sounds a little crazy because we're a family that founded it.
You guys historically created Cava as an idea, but you've removed yourselves from it now.
Exactly, because the original idea has been misled, and Cava has become too of a cheap volume-oriented sparkling wine, and we believe there is a strong potential for highest-end sparkling wines that can rival the best terroirs of the world. So we create a new appellation called Conca, C-O-N-C-A, that stands for Valley in Catalan, and it's the valley of the River Noia, so it's going to be very limited geographically produced, excuse me for my language, and only indigenous grapes, biodynamically and organically farmed, always vintage, 18 months on the lease, so very, very strict when making requisites.
And so what is the range of Conca that Reventos is going to be making?
You mean the products?
Yeah.
Well, basically, you know our wine, Tony. Basically, we produce a single vineyard called Clos del Serral, which is from the best vineyard of the property, north face, with 80-year-old plants of Xarello between the lake and the forest at a temperate in ripening. And then we have De la Finca, which is a selection of hill east and northeast-oriented plots. A rosé called Denit, that is probably our best-known wine because it's become very successful in the last years, and Lereu from La Viña de la Plana. Basically, what we do is, from every vintage, we do vinification of the different terroirs because our goal is to express what happens in our terroir, in our nature, in our soils, in our climate, rather than to do a perfect winemaking thing.
Is there a champagne style that you chase, or you think it's just a different planet and not worried about
it? That's a great question. I think the more we learn, the more far away we want to be from champagne. Not because we don't love it, that we do, and I have so many friends there and travel there all the time, but because we think that in order to apport something to the world of wines, you have to be really the most authentic that you can, no? And in this sense, we want to develop something super unique, super local. That's why we only use indigenous grapes, and we're focusing on understanding the best we can our terroir.
Pepe, what did you study when you went to school?
Well, my first education, as you know, Cindy, is in America, in business, and that's why I really love your country so much and traveling the world to promote our wines, because in the early stages we were only sold in Spain. No? Mm-hmm. After I did enology degree in the University of Ingenieros Agronomos in Madrid, I studied for sommelier in the restaurant school in Barcelona. Mm-hmm. But most important, I have been doing wines with people that really have influenced my way of understanding and everyday influenced the way of understanding wines. I'd like to mention only Didier Daguenot in Loire, with whom I did a vintage before he passed away. It was a deep understanding. Jean-Patrick Mérignac in Bordeaux, and other friends that I don't want to belong in Burgundy and Champagne and in Germany.
And so do you have a favorite dish for the wines that you all make?
I think the best thing for our sparklers and for Conca in general is that we can produce extremely mineral-oriented sparkling wines with a strong salinity concept into it, a kind of an ocean mineral expression, if you wish. And this gives the wine a lot of versatility with especially long gastronomic menus, like the one, for example, you guys shared or invited us at the Charleston that night. No, these long gastronomic high-end menus, I think, for our wines are great, because the wine respects from early stages appetizers to it can even hold on a duck or on a lamb-based dish. However, let me go as autochthone and say that the tradition in Catalonia is to mix ingredients from the ocean and from the mountains. And I will just call a dish called arroz a la cassola. Arroz a la cassola is a rice that was originally produced in the farms with the ingredients, cheap ingredients, leftovers that would be, so they could feed a big family. And you would use a little bit of rabbit or chicken or whatever was left, or pork, and then vegetables and the rice. And sometimes you would add ingredients from the ocean. I think that with this type of rices, a Conca with 3-4 years old on the list, it's just fantastic.
And we had a dish when we ate lunch with your father that day at the winery, and it had fava beans in it. That was, I will never forget that. It was so good. Is that's something that's traditional to the Barcelona region or that area?
Yes, Cindy, they are called favas a la catalana, so Catalan fava beans or Catalan way cooked fava beans. And yes, basically it's this mix of the fava beans. If I don't want to be mistaken, there's a little bit of blood pork sausage on it that gives it strong flavor.
Yeah.
A little bit of a base of an onion in the beginning, right?
So good. You can definitely taste some sort of pork or product in it. And those beans were remarkable. Delicious. Simplicity in cooking, perfection. A treat.
So as you're spending a lot of time in the U.S. right now, what are the five restaurants, maybe some fancy, some not fancy at all, that you miss the most in Spain?
Wow, that's a tough one. I think among the fancy ones, my favorite restaurant of all times is Mugaris. I was in a very philosophical moment and really impacted by the way that Andoni is understanding the Basque cuisine. I was very shocked and amazed for the conceptual behind the kitchen, rather than just maybe the you guys are professional of restaurants and maybe you'd say that the service or some of the goods, but the overall concept, I think it was amazing, no? Going less fancy, the thing I miss the most are these rural restaurants in mountain or more abandoned areas. For example, Kalchim, Chim, X-I-M, is a very unknown little restaurant in a village called San Pau d'Ordal near, in the middle of our wine region in Penedès, which is fantastic. They do very simple a la brasa, vegetables, pork, bacalao. That's also something I would like to mention. What else? Let me say a couple quick things in Barcelona. I really miss going to a place like Bar Cañete, for example, no, where you can have these fantastic, so well-poured, fresh beers with informal but perfectly executed tapas. And I think here I am having the best oysters in my life. But about other seafood, I would call something like these very casual restaurants by the ocean where you can have a very fresh seafood and white fish of an excellent quality that I haven't been able to find here yet.
Seafood in Spain, that's one of the things that I never want to stop eating seafood in Spain, because things are so often right out of the water. It must be in the U.S. It seems like we often ship seafood all over the place instead of just you go to the water, you eat what was caught, simply prepared. It seems we have all this coastline and we don't get seafood to market very quickly. It's amazing.
That's true. Although I have to say that the oysters and the salmon that, for example, I am tasting here and the clams are great.
Good.
Great.
We had the wonderful treat of going to El Bulli with you, Pepe, when El Bulli was still open. Again, another experience I will never forget, and you know, we should talk about that for a minute.
Mostly I want to ask, what was the strangest course that you think we had that night?
If you remember.
I think the best thing of El Bulli is that these guys did such a great job with such humility. They were so humble that they make really, the gastronomic experience became a big party, and then at the end of the day, it was all about the people, and that's what really counts, the company and the great time you're having there.
Yeah, the room is a remarkably comfortable room. The sommelier was a super talented young sommelier. That cellar was crazy, super ridiculous.
And you were extremely generous with the wines, and that really helped.
We have to drink something decent.
That's a great experience.
It's important. And so, any food surprises for you in the U.S.?
Yeah, definitely. What we are enjoying the most, especially now, this winters that we have spent in New York, is the different origins that can be mixed in such a small place, no? From Mission Chinese and the Lower East Side, when you can experience a wonderful, super spicy hot Chinese in a very casual way, to a great Ethiopian restaurant in Harlem, or a simple Italian, excellent cooked pasta that I don't find in Spain, here across the street, no?
Very good.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the program with us, Pepe. Hope to see you soon.
Oh, nice to talk with you, Pepe.
Oh, guys, thank you. It's very nice to talk to you, and I hope that our little experience can entertain or be some help. And if anybody needs a tour to Raventos, just check www.raventos.com online and contact us, and we'll be happy to show you around.
Well, we'll put the Raventos link up on the website, and maybe a few of the restaurants that you mentioned have sites that we can list on the website for Formula Wolf.
That was great to talk with Pepe. Tony, what did we drink at El Bulli? I don't remember. It was several years ago.
Drinking wine or having wine open with Pepe is always a bit of a contest because, like you said, he went to sommelier school, so he always wants to do a little bit of blind. He's like, he's a little poking you on that kind of stuff.
That's okay.
And so what I had the sommelier open, I think my favorite thing that night we had open was a 92 Richebourg from the Benelux Romanée Conti. That was a bit of a sleeper wine. It was a bit of a sleeper vintage.
Mm-hmm.
There were some 92 Grand Crus that are great if you kind of know who dealt with a vintage well, because it wasn't an even vintage.
There you go. Well, and also we had another restaurateur with us at that dinner. And we had just eaten. His brother is a chef, and he was amazing to sit down and have dinner with as well. And he brought some wine, too, I believe. So We really had quite
a... We digested our meal very successfully.
Yes, we did. After, what was it, 38 courses at El Bulli?
It was something. There was something with Parmesan cheese in it in little plastic packages that you broke open that bubbled.
Yes.
I do recall that particular part of the sequence.
And we were supposed to dip it in hot water for 3.4 seconds.
Something like
and
that.
And I remember looking at the waiter and thinking, gosh, really? But anyway.
We've got one listener question to answer, and if you do have questions for us on food and wine, you send it to foremanwolf@wypr.org. So please send any emailed questions to foremanwolf@wypr.org. And the question about tannin, I hear you referring to grape tannins. What are grape tannins? Tannins are a vegetable material. I don't want to get scientific quickly, but it's the business that comes from the seeds or skins or stems of a grape, and you feel it in your mouth almost the same way that if you oversteep tea, the way it sort of dries your mouth, or you can feel it on your teeth. It's that vegetable material that you feel. And different kinds of wines all have, because all come from skins, all have and spend time on the skins. They leach out tannins from the skins. Reds have a lot more than whites, but young whites sometimes you'll notice have almost like a crunchy character that comes from that. Some dry wines, wines that dry your mouth more, tend to, like Cabernet Sauvignon, Syrah, Zinfandel, Aglianico. Those grapes are ones with small amounts of flesh and very thick skins and lots of seeds, and they tend to give you more tannic wines. Tannins also keep the wines for a lot longer in the cellar. The question is often about, if something's very tannic, does it have enough fruit to live through the life of its tannin to actually be pleasurable to drink at the end of it? Great Bordeaux is the one, like, you know, sort of poster child for legendary, very tannic wines that live a very long time. So, anyway, and that's a question I could ridiculously go on about and bore everyone to death about for 2 hours. I'm glad it was 2 minutes.
Okay. No, it was well said and really interesting, because I think it is interesting that what is the structure of wine, and how does it last forever, and why does it change when it's in the cellar? And
well, it is a type of acidity, too. It's another thing to say about it.
Exactly.
Anyway, thanks so much for listening to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine, and we'll see you next time.